This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 26th of June. There's been a testy series of exchanges between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer in their final head-to-head debate of the general election campaign. We'll get reaction from the Labour and the Conservative front benches. There's a coup underway in Bolivia, it would appear. We'll get the latest. We'll also hear about a U-turn from Kenya's president following a day of deadly protests against his tax plans. And Pete Townsend on The Who's classic album Quadrophenia being turned into a ballet. And this evening, the country had the chance to listen to and watch Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer take part in their final head-to-head debate before polling stations open next Thursday, 8 days' time. A final chance in prime time for the Conservative and Labour leaders to define themselves and their policies to voters and against each other at the BBC debate at Nottingham Trent University, modified by Michelle Hussein. Well, our political correspondent Leila Nathu is also there and joins us now. Leila, it was possibly, I think, an even more testy set of exchanges between the two of them than we've had until now. Would you agree?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think especially for Rishi Sunak, actually, was very animated. I think his calculation that it was worth was that it was worth taking the chance, sort of talking over Keir Starmer and indeed Michelle Hussein repeatedly to get his point across, repeatedly saying there was a clear choice, trying to present himself as sort of being unapologetic about his party's position, whether you like it or not. He sort of said that quite openly, questioning his Keir Starmer's convictions. His strategy was saying, look, you don't know what you're going to get with Keir Starmer. He chops and changes all the time. Keir Starmer, I think it felt to me, at times was under more scrutiny over the detail of his plans. He, for his part, was accusing Rishi Sunak of lying about the claims he was making over potential tax rises under Labour, clearly getting quite agitated. But there were various clashes over tax, over the issue of immigration, and on the welfare system. Have a listen to this first exchange for a flavour of the tone. It begins with our colleague Michelle questioning Keir Starmer about Rishi Sunak wanting to tighten eligibility criteria for benefits.
What is wrong, if you believe it is wrong, what Rishi Sunak is saying, that if someone is offered a job and they can do that job and they turn it down, that's wrong?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. And I just want to address Beverly's point.
You opposed it when I announced it.
You literally opposed it. If you listen to people in the audience across the country more often, you might not be quite so out of touch.
That was a point Keir Starmer tried to return to throughout the debate. And I think it's worth saying that both men did get applause at various points for various different ideas they were conveying. One of the particularly testy exchanges was on immigration. Rishi Sunak defending his Rwanda plan, saying that it was the only deterrent to stop people crossing the channel in small boats, and really going after Keir Starmer to say, what actually is your plan if you oppose it? Have a listen to this exchange.
Do you know where these people come from?
No, he's not answering the question.
Do you know where they come from? Iran.
You can see.
Syria. Afghanistan. So when Keir Starmer says he's going to return people, is he going to sit down? Are you going to sit down with the Iranian Ayatollahs? Are you going to try and do a deal with the Taliban? It's completely nonsensical what you are saying, right? You are taking people for fools.
Well, Leila, these occasions are, of course, when the leaders do try to get across those core messages that have defined their campaign. And they managed to do that again, didn't they?
Yeah, sort of last chance saloon, really, with just over a week to go for the leaders to try and really get their pitch to people who may not have tuned in so far, but who might now be focusing their minds. But I thought it was quite interesting that we got a new line from Rishi Sunak tonight, the repeated use of the word surrender. He was talking about not surrendering, asking people not to surrender the borders, their family finances, the welfare system, their local council to the Labour Party and to Keir Starmer. There was a really interesting question from one member of the audience who criticised both men, actually saying to Rishi Sunak, look, you did a decent job as Chancellor, but I think you're a pretty mediocre Prime Minister. Keir Starmer, I think your strings are being pulled by senior Labour Party figures, asking them outright, are you two really the best we've got to be the next Prime Minister? And that really allowed them both to make their pitches, to kind of give their CVs. But I want to just play you a little clip about an exchange specifically about taxes on pensioners. This is one of the crucial dividing lines, certainly something that Rishi Sunak was going after Keir Starmer on. Have a listen to this about the Conservative promise for pensioners.
there is a retirement tax coming for you, capital R, capital T, if he is your Prime Minister.
He can promise
for the first time in our country's history, pensioners are going to be paying tax because he won't match our triple lock plus. If I'm your Prime Minister, that won't happen, and that's what I'll deliver for you. As I say it again, do not surrender your finances to their tax rises.
If you've got a very brief response, then I want to go to the next question.
Well, pensioners are not going to be better off with a Prime Minister who's making promises that he can't keep because they're not funded. That's exactly what Liz Truss got wrong.
A lot of reference from Keir Starmer to the past 14 years, really wanting to focus voters' minds on 14 years of Conservative governments in the round. Repeated mentions of Liz Truss, that is something we've heard from the Labour Party throughout this campaign. But again, Keir Starmer trying to return also to the Prime Minister's personal situation, and have a listen to this rather interesting exchange on a question of our trading relationship with the EU.
Part of the problem we have with this Prime Minister is that his lived world is millions of miles away from the lived worlds of individuals across the country, the businesses and the families that they're trying to support. There's a massive gap. That is a problem.
But again, you just won't rule out. Will you accept any greater migration as the price of a deal with the EU? Yes or no?
No, I don't. But I would say this, that migration, lawful migration, is at record numbers under this Prime Minister. He's actually the most liberal Prime Minister we've ever had when it comes to immigration. The numbers have gone through the roof. They're actually far higher than they were when we were in the EU. So I really don't think you can start lecturing other people about higher migration. They've never been as high as they are on your watch.
A flavour there of the debate tonight, moderated, not modified, as I said earlier, of course, by Michelle Hussain and Leila Nathu, our correspondent there, bringing us that flavour. Well, joining us now for some reaction, we have Victoria Atkins, the Conservative Health Secretary, and also in the spin room in Nottingham, Jonathan Ashworth, Labour's Shadow Paymaster General. Good evening to both of you.
Good evening.
Victoria Atkins, let me start with you by addressing the issue that's sort of been swirling around now for several days, if not longer, that the question of betting, because tonight The Sun is reporting Conservative candidate Philip Davis placed an £8,000 bet on losing his seat at the general election. Should he be suspended in the way that a Labour candidate who did something similar allegedly has been?
I hope your listeners will understand I've been watching the debate tonight and focused on tonight, so I don't know the details of that allegation. But what I do know is that tonight we saw the Prime Minister setting out very clearly the choice that is facing us in just over a week's time. And this is not some fanciful exercise or a by-election. This is a choice that will determine the future of our country and how our country is governed over the next 5 years. And we saw with Rishi Sunak tonight that we have plans, we have fully funded plans and answers on the most difficult issues of the day, whether it's our economy, whether it's immigration, whether it's the future of our public services, or indeed the definition of a woman. And Rishi set these out. Sir Keir Starmer, I have to say, interestingly, appeared to be under some pressure. For example, on the tackling immigration question, he was asked at least 9 times, what is your plan? And he refused to answer. And the public is starting to see this. Labour have to tell the public what they're up to.
Well, let's,
because we have a very clear choice next Thursday.
Well, let's find out what the answer is. Jonathan Ashworth, he was asked repeatedly about that, what Labour would do about asylum seekers, people who have currently arrived in the UK illegally. What is the answer?
Well, let me just offer my reflection first, as you allowed Victoria to offer her reflection in her preamble. I thought Keir Starmer looked like a Prime Minister tonight. I thought Rishi Sunak looked desperate. I thought he looked scratchy. And I think the choice facing the British public now is whether they want change after 14 years of failure, or whether they want 5 more years of this man, Rishi Sunak. And if they get 5 more years of this man, Rishi Sunak, nothing will change. In fact, we'll see further decline. Because one of the questions Rishi Sunak could not answer when pressed repeatedly by Keir Starmer was the charge that every single one of his commitments in his manifesto are commitments he cannot fund, based on savings he cannot find, because Jeremy Hunt has said in his newsletter to his constituents in his marginal constituency that the £12 billion worth of savings have already been spent. What you will get with Rishi Sunak is the same mistakes Liz Truss made unfunded spending commitments, well, more borrowing, and people's mortgages going up.
So you've also talked about a question that your opponent didn't answer. Victoria Atkins, I'll come back to you on that, but let me just get Jonathan Ashworth to answer on the illegal immigration issue.
Well, we've got a plan to smash the boats. You heard, to smash the gangs, to stop the boats. Rishi Sunak promised to stop the boats, and we had 50,000 people cross in the boats. But I'm quite keen to hear Victoria's retort to me, because Rishi Sunak wasn't able to answer this question tonight. So Jeremy Hunt said the money wasn't there. It's already been spent.
Jeremy's,
so where's the money coming
Jeremy's
from?
Jeremy's leaflet was saying we have already made changes that has caused these savings, and we are offering that as evidence. Your boss
that's
is a former barrister.
No,
your boss is a former barrister. He will rely on the evidence.
Just let Victoria Atkins finish, please.
As we have secured these savings so we can secure more, because we know that the welfare bill is running at a, it is running too high. We have to tackle it in a compassionate and caring way and ensure that people are supported back into work, not just because it helps them financially, but because it is, it helps our welfare as well.
I don't
think
you've read his leaflet.
And if anyone should be asking about interesting comments made about funding, I wonder if we'll talk about the Shadow Treasury Minister's promise that Labour's net zero policies are going to cost hundreds of billions.
And this was Darren Jones's comments that have been played by the Daily Telegraph.
At least Victoria put up a more spirited defence of Jeremy Hunt than Rishi Sunak did tonight. But I've known Victoria for a while. I'm not surprised at that. But Jeremy Hunt says in his leaflet that the $12 billion is already funding the existing national insurance cuts. Therefore, that money has been spent.
Okay.
It cannot fund future tax cuts. You're making the same mistakes Liz Truss made. You're going to go on a borrowing bonanza.
Jonathan Ashworth, on that question of Darren Jones talking about hundreds of billions needed to meet net zero requirements.
Yeah, he's talking about private sector investment.
Because no,
we're a party hand in hand with the private sector. I've actually read quote. They're pretty embarrassing. I've done this for the Tory party to put that out from their researchers. we see this stuff in election campaigns. He literally says in the quotation, we're talking about private sector investment, not taxation.
If you read it, he's talking about spending.
The Tory party's so desperate.
He's talking about spending.
I've never seen the Tory party so desperate.
Jonathan,
in
just let Victor Atkins
respond.
This is
very serious. Please don't mansplain to me.
That's not mansplaining.
This is about it's another Labour man telling a woman to shut up. That's also a common theme in this election campaign.
I was not saying that. You know me well.
So next Thursday, we have a choice as to how our country is governed and how our taxes are imposed and what we're prepared to see. When the Prime Minister asked Sir Keir Starmer to come clean on tax rises tonight, he would not do so. But we know from Darren Jones's own private meeting that has been reported that, in fact, the Labour Party are planning to spend.
And can I ask you something that does unite both of your leaders? And that was the question from the audience member who basically asked, are you really the two best that this country can come up with? Does that not point to a level of voter apathy and disenchantment that neither of your parties, neither of your leaders have been able to overturn? Jonathan Ashworth.
Well, look, in the end, the choice facing the country is a Labour government led by Keir Starmer, or 5 more years of desperate Rishi Sunak and the decline under a Tory government. And that is the choice facing the country. And if people do want change after 14 years of failure, they've got to vote Labour on July the 4th.
Victoria Atkins, what about that question of general that neither of them are really the right person for the job question?
Well, when the Prime Minister came into the role, he pledged that he would work to bring inflation back to target. If you remember when he took over, inflation was some 11%. It is now back at target. And that has a huge impact on us all because it means that our cost of living is not hit by that horrible inflationary pressures. We have also pledged to grow the economy. And again, we've seen the economy grow since 2016 faster than our equivalent countries. And this matters because this is central to the Conservatives' values and principles.
And can I
the
just
Labour
a very
talk
quick,
about change. They keep changing their principles.
Well, can
they
I just put to you that there's a Snap YouGov poll tonight which says the debate was a draw, and given where you are in the opinion polls, Victoria Atkins, that's probably not going to be enough, is it?
Well, all I would say is that those Labour politicians who are taking the public for granted do so at their own risk, because the oldest rule in politics is you never take the public for granted. And I know from campaigning not only in my own constituency of Louth and Horncastle but around the country that what we're hearing on the doorsteps is not what we are seeing in the polls.
Okay,
the only day that matters, the only poll that matters is next Thursday.
Taking the public for granted,
really,
Jonathan Ashworth?
Choice.
I agree with Victoria. These opinion polls are wild. There is no way Rishi Sunak's going to take the Tory party down to be the third party behind the Liberal Party. I don't believe it for a moment. The truth is, there's still lots of people who have yet to make their mind up. So if you want change, if you want to bring an end to the Tory government, if you don't want five more years of Rishi Sunak, you have got to go out there and vote Labour next Thursday.
Okay, Jonathan Ashworth, Victoria Atkins, thank you both very much. And tomorrow, as part of our ongoing election coverage, we'll be reporting from Cambridge about a matter close to Victoria Atkins and Jonathan Ashworth, former Shadow Health Secretary. It's about challenges facing the health service and the efforts to use technology to make the NHS more innovative and efficient. Sean Lay will be reporting from Addenbrookes Hospital. And just a reminder, we do want to reflect the election issues that matter to you on the programme. So do get in touch to tell us what you want explained or covered in more detail. And we specifically do want to hear from you if you're still one of the many undecided, the so-called floating voters or don't knows. Just 8 days to go, of course. Are you any closer to deciding how you'll cast your vote? Has tonight's debate helped you? Well, just let us know on text. We're at 84844. 10 to 15 pence is the charge for that. You can also get in touch via WhatsApp 03700 100 444, or you can email us world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. Now, we're going to turn to matters overseas, because in the past hour, there have been reports of a military coup underway in Bolivia, where hundreds of soldiers and armoured vehicles have encircled government buildings in the city of La Paz. Well, following events is our correspondent in the region, Will Grant. He's on the line now from Mexico City. Will, a developing situation, what do we know?
Well, it really is very fluid at the moment. What we know is that the president of Bolivia, Luis Arce, has denounced what he's called the irregular mobilization of troops in La Paz that you could hear taking place there. Meanwhile, of course, he's been backed in that criticism by presidents the length and breadth of Latin America. The United States has said it's monitoring the situation closely. Now, the general who appears to be leading this uprising, the general of the army, Juan José Zúñiga, has said that he recognizes President Arce, as he put it, for the moment, but that there would be a change of ministers and cabinet. Now, a lot of analysts on Bolivian affairs are saying this amounts to essentially some kind of soft coup, or what they call an alto golpe in Spanish in Bolivia, a self coup. Of course, Mr. Arce has urged those breakaway members of the military to sort of come back to his side. But as I say, it's very, very fluid and very worrying for those people in and around La Paz watching it unfold.
And put this into some historical context, if you will. Will, what is the recent history of Bolivia?
So there was a coup in 2019, or a military-led forcing of former President Evo Morales from power, and it's thought that this may partly be related to that. The military are looking for some of those who were arrested over that uprising that forced Mr. Morales from power to be pardoned, and they were very, very angry about the handling of the whole affair, how the military men were, as they saw it, put out to dry, and that the whole thing was sort of crushed, even though they believed it to have been legitimate. Evo Morales and Mr. Arce, the President Arce, were once allies, but in recent months have been really at loggerheads. But that's much more a question of a split within the left in Latin, in Bolivia, and there is no sense in which Mr. Morales is anyway behind this coup. He's one of the loudest voices denouncing it. So, yeah, it is a return, if you like, to some of the bad old days in Bolivia, a country that suffered almost more coups than anywhere else in the region. Was very, very politically unstable for a very long time, indeed, until Evo Morales came onto the scene and was in power for around about two decades.
Well, thanks very much. As Will says, a fluid situation there in Bolivia. Now, we have had our final leaders' head-to-head election debate, but the Americans, well, they're just preparing for their first one tomorrow night. And that's a full 4 months before November's presidential election. The Joe Biden-Donald Trump rematch has given this year's contest there an air of weary familiarity, although there is still one big unknown. Who will be Mr. Trump's running mate? Well, the former Republican president has certainly enjoyed fueling speculation. In 2016, he picked the governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, as a way to court the evangelical Christian vote. But Mr. Pence, well, he fell out of favour after refusing to help overturn the 2020 election result. So, who will it be this time around? And what might the thinking be behind Donald Trump's choice? The BBC's Neda Taufik has been taking a look at some of the rumoured contenders.
We need Donald Trump!
Donald J. Trump will make America great again. Thank you.
In what feels like the VP edition of The Apprentice, there's no shortage of contenders vying to be Donald Trump's running mate. Among the reported shortlist, a governor from the fourth least populous state of North Dakota, a black Southern Republican senator, a Cuban-American senator from Florida, a Trump country so-called intellectual populist, and a millennial congresswoman from New York.
Given his penchant for drama, I think his preference really is to keep people guessing.
Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota believes it's highly likely Trump will pick the governor of his state, Doug Burgum.
Who are we going to send back to the White House? Trump!
Like Trump, he entered politics in 2016 as a businessman. The wealthy governor made his fortune by mortgaging his family's farm to invest in a software company, which he later took public and sold to Microsoft for $1.1 billion in 2001.
He brings a stability, brings a knowledge of how to run a corporation, how to run a family farm, how to run a grain elevator. And I do think Doug's governing of the energy boom in North Dakota is very appealing to Donald Trump and to his message. And I do think that Doug Burgum balances some of the more impulse, if you will, and the big personality of Donald Trump.
So get ready for something, okay? Just get ready. But Doug Burgum has been incredible.
Myra Adams, a former Republican and an op-ed writer for the U.S. political website The Hill, also believes Burgum is the favorite to take it. Despite running in the Republican presidential primary, Governor Burgum doesn't have much of a national profile. She is betting that Trump wants someone photogenic who will staunchly defend him, but who will not outshine him.
Talk about a nothing burger. My little town has more people than North Dakota, but he doesn't present any kind of problem. He would just be a vanilla, just a vanilla old rich guy.
If Trump is more focused on a VP who could bring in additional votes, Myra is among those who say Senator Marco Rubio of Florida is the better choice.
He speaks Spanish. And that is so key. I can't emphasize that enough. This will be the first election where the Hispanic vote is projected to be larger than the black vote. Biden won 67% of Hispanic Catholics compared to 32% for Trump. Rubio could really help with Hispanic Catholics. Plus, Rubio is very experienced. He's vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee. But I don't think Trump trusts him. I think Trump believes that Rubio is just looking to be president.
Considered up with Burgum and Rubio in the top three is the new Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
Let's rebuild prosperity for America's citizens and reelect Donald J. Trump.
He once wondered whether Trump was America's Hitler, but is now close to Trump's son, Don Jr. He is seen by some as more useful in Congress and unlikely to add much to the ticket. And what about a running mate that could help with key demographic groups that lean Democrat? Here's senior advisor to the Trump 2016 campaign, Dave Urban.
do you think women who may be suspect of Donald Trump would somehow overcome their suspicion, be overcome by having just a woman on the ticket? And the same goes for having an African-American on the ticket. Again, wouldn't it be the ultimate irony that if the vice president were picked, somebody not on the list? Right? Wouldn't that be the ultimate in showmanship?
Whoever it is would not only be a heartbeat away from the presidency should Trump win, but potentially the future leader of the party for years to come.
Neda Taufik reporting. Quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this program or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. You can also listen back to the full debate between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer on BBC Sounds as well. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight: Rishi Sunak and Sir Keir Starmer have traded blows on taxes, public spending, immigration, and the trustworthiness of politicians in their final leaders' debate before the general election. In the last hour, there have been reports of a military coup in Bolivia with tanks and troops surrounding government buildings in La Paz. And the US Supreme Court has accidentally published a ruling on a major abortion rights case, which appears to overturn a near total ban on abortions in the state of Idaho. Now, on yesterday's programme, we told you about a day of deadly violence on the streets of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. That was the sound of police firing at young people who were protesting against tax rises in a new finance bill. Some of the protesters managed to get into the Parliament building, which was set on fire and vandalised. More than 20 people were reportedly killed in the protests. Kenya's President William Ruto initially said that the military would be deployed and that violence wouldn't be tolerated. But today, he struck a very different tone.
Having reflected on the continuing conversation around the content of the Finance Bill 2024 and listening keenly to the people of Kenya, who have said loudly that they want nothing to do with this Finance Bill 2024, I concede, and therefore I will not sign the 2024 Finance Bill.
Chris is one of the young Kenyans who joined yesterday's protest. So what does he make of the president's U-turn?
It's a great victory, I think, for the youth, because for once we feel like our voice has been heard. I mean, assuming that it actually goes to pass, because saying it is one thing, but like the actual implementation, we'll have to wait and see.
You're skeptical, are you?
Yeah, I mean, until we see it, it's not the first time we've been promised things by politicians and it didn't come to pass. So we'd have to wait and see. But generally, I mean, it goes beyond just the finance bill. It's really just holding our leaders accountable, which I think was the big outcome from this. Because the leaders went through with this bill despite the protests and despite each and every county coming up and telling people, like, we don't want this thing. But they decided to go through with it. So the fact that it's been stopped in its tracks feels like a win.
President does sound pretty clear. He said, listening keenly to the people of Kenya who have said loudly they want nothing to do with this finance bill, I concede I will not sign it. It will subsequently be withdrawn. The people have spoken. What would you like to see happen now? Because the debt is still there, isn't it? The remedy is one that you didn't like and the president is now saying he's not going to go ahead with, but there's still a massive debt that needs to be addressed, isn't there?
Yeah, the debt is definitely one massive elephant in the room. But I think the questions which the youth were asking is, I mean, how did we get to this point to begin with? And he did touch on that very, very lightly today. But also one of the things that all of us were protesting about is actually the government spending. No one would have had such a big issue with the taxes had we actually known that, like, the money is going towards something meaningful. The big issue people had is that when you're seeing renovations being done for hundreds of billions on buildings that genuinely don't need renovations, and at the same time, there's hospitals that don't have medicine, for example, right? So I think the conversation is going to go on and spill over from just beyond this finance bill to actually the government spending. We're basically drowning in debt and no one can really point out a significant development that this government has done in the last 2 years.
What about the generational divide? As you say, it's a youth movement, the feeling that the young people are having to pay for the profligacy of the older generations. How do you kind of bridge this generational divide, which seems to be very obvious when you look on the streets?
I mean, I don't think it's really such a divide. I think what it is just that the youth have finally woken up. I mean, the facts speak for themselves. If we look at the last election, I believe there's something like 8 million people that did not vote, majority of whom were youth. Most of the youth were just so disengaged by the political class. There was a lot of apathy and just general disregard, really, for politics. But now guys have woken up because we've seen firsthand that if we don't actually engage these people, this is our future that's going to be messed up.
You've seen protests, you've seen these killings, and then you've seen an apparent government U-turn. How would you sum up what has happened in your country?
There's a few key things I think that have happened. I don't think it's happened before, at least in my lifetime, of like the government actually realizing that they can't take the youth for granted anymore. The youth have not really been heard previously. Again, largely our fault. But guys have woken up, and most importantly, our leaders have realized that they can't just keep taking us for a ride. Previous generations maybe would have been a bit more maybe practical about how to go about it. But the youth just decided we're not going to wait until the next election for these guys to hear us, especially when they're the people who are supposed to be representing us. So I'd say like the big summary of all of this is that the political class can no longer ignore the youth. And they know now that they have to actually account to these people, because this new generation of voters is going to hold them to task. We're asking questions which none of the other generations were asking before. We're asking for a lot more accountability, a lot more transparency. So yeah, I think we're asking the right questions. And I think generally this is going to be a huge positive for Kenya. And most importantly, we don't have the fear that maybe previous generations might have.
That was one of the Kenyan protesters, Chris. It started off as a rock opera. It was made into a cult film starring Phil Daniels, Leslie Ash and Sting. And much later, it was reinvented as an orchestral piece. Well, now, Quadrophenia, the classic 1973 album by The Who, is getting another artistic makeover, this time as a ballet. Sadler's Wells is producing Quadrophenia, a mod ballet, which will introduce new audiences to the stories of 1960s mod Jimmy Cooper and his escape from depression through dancing, taking drugs, riding his scooter and fighting rockers in Brighton. Well, The Who's guitarist Pete Townsend, who wrote the album, his wife Rachel Fuller, is behind the orchestral arrangement that will accompany the ballet, which is being staged next year. That ballet is still being worked on, but Pete Townsend has seen some of the early versions of the dancers, and I asked him, what's it like to see Quadrophenia in ballet form?
I just thought, wow, this is the old story, but definitely in new clothes. It feels completely different. It definitely had poetic nuance for me, anyway.
You've talked about the physicality of entertainment being important. Is that an important element of this?
Well, today it has to be, doesn't it? Everything is online. Everything's in the virtual world. One of the things that we have left is theatre. In this case, it's modern dance, really, but all of the company are from the ballet world. There's a challenge for them to rise to the physicality of a great rock concert.
How would you compare what we're going to see eventually, the performance, to a rock concert?
It's not going to be a rock concert, really. It's orchestral. There are no drums banging away. There are no electric guitars. It's a very, very pure orchestral piece in the tradition of traditional ballet. It's a really pure ballet experience. However, this is the Quadrophenia story. I do hope that it interests anybody that's followed the Quadrophenia story, that liked the movie, that liked the Who's version, has followed the Who's tours and so on in the past, because I think this is another shade. This is really new. It feels really exciting to me.
And the story, the basic story is the same, but does it have a different contemporary ring?
The story of Jimmy in Quadrophenia back in 1964 was one of a disenfranchised young boy for whom everything becomes empty and meaningless. And I think a lot of young people will identify with this. I hope when we get to the ending, we haven't workshopped the ending yet, but when we get there, that we find some way to end with some transcendence and some hope.
As you say, the themes of alienation amongst sort of young people are timeless, obviously, but obviously it was of a time when you had the mods and rockers How are you making it relevant to a modern audience? Are you going to be explicitly talking about contemporary themes, knife crime, etc.?
No, not at all. I don't think it would be appropriate to do so. We have to deal with this in a fairy tale manner, in a mythic manner. It's a very old piece. It stands in classic British noir, and that's where it should belong. The real parallel is about polarization. This is what we are facing in society today. We felt as kids back in the 60s that we had to create our own new world. We felt that the old world, there was nothing wrong with it. It wasn't counterfeit in any way. It just didn't fit for us. That's where I feel the current generation must be feeling. They're battling to create a new world, a new society, and a new order.
And for you, this was, I think, your most personal album, wasn't it? Certainly during your Who days, it was the one that it was all yours. When you give it up to other artists to interpret, what's that like for you? Is that a bit nerve-wracking?
No, I think the first bit of giving up was giving it up to The Who. You know, I wrote it for two reasons. The main reason was to try to remind The Who where we had come from and what our job was, which was to sustain and entertain and provide hope and solace to our audience. The design of this show is going to be spectacular. It's going to feel right of its time, but also it's going to be clear what we're trying to say. If you believe in the original art, then you have to allow it to be reset, reimagined, and allowed to fly again.
Fly again and flying through the air, because that was Pete Townsend looking ahead to Quadrophenia, a mod ballet. Now, before we go, a quick look at tomorrow's front page, as many of them covering tonight's BBC election debate. Of course, the Daily Mail's front headline says, "You are taking people for fools," what the paper calls Rishi Sunak's furious blast at Keir Starmer during that debate. And the Times headline reads, "Sunak rams home tax message in final debate." One other headline today, the Metropolitan Police have put out a statement this evening saying they are going to lead on a small number of the election betting cases where offending includes offences such as misconduct in public office. They have said they will be providing more information tomorrow. So it would appear that particular story is not going away. That is it, though, for The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone here on the programme, have a very good night.